wanted a chance to make law. Well, here it is. Make it a good one.
Is this your gun?
No.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
We have your name on the registration.
No, you don't.
Don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
Your Honors, I'm not some slick big city lawyer like my opponent here.
What just happened? You kind of confessed. Sorry.
And I find you guilty. Bring out the wheel of punishment!
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 456. Oh, 456. Cool. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic on a level that has not been seen since we did episode 1, 2, 3. So there you go.
Yeah, we're going to complete the set, you know. This is the middle. So, yeah. I name the shows, but I have to give you full credit for this episode. Insurrections Have Consequences. Fantastic show name. Amazing content that I'm seeing a lot of bullet points, but they're so good that I'm like, we'll see, you know, maybe we go long. I don't care. This show is going to be amazing. Consequences, everybody. Can we have some of them?
It would be nice, don't you think? So
we already have some, you know, in that the president was impeached. First president. I don't know if you've heard all this. This just in. First president ever to be impeached twice. Pretty cool.
I maybe came across that while, you know, prepping the stories for
this
week.
It's an obscure bit of trivia that you won't have heard about except for on this show. The only other president to be impeached twice was nobody, is the thing. Right. All right. Well, apparently I see in the announcement section here, Lynn Wood next week. Did we book Lynn Wood? Yes. Awesome.
We are not having that asshole on the show. I guess you can clown horn that out. But no. To go along with insurrections have consequences, they have already had consequences for the person who is really trying to dominate the top of the charts of America's worst lawyer, L. Lynn Wood. And I have a fantastic story involving how a judge in state court in Delaware really brought the hammer down on Mr. Wood. It's a fantastic story. We don't have time for it this week, so tune in next week.
Yeah, I'm glad we're not having Lynn Wood on, because we might lose our entire website and our Twitters and our Facebooks, the whole internet collapse underneath us. We're not having Lynn Wood on.
Yeah, Opening Arguments live from Parler.
Good luck with that. Also doesn't exist. All right, well, let's get to our consequences show. Overdue.
Down. 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 Down.
This just in. The president was impeached. Andrew, I'm told he's the only president to be impeached twice. Can you believe it? Tell us about the impeachment the second time. Impeachment 2, electric.
I think Noah had the best, which was if we're doing sequels, then Impeachment 2, Secret of the Ooze is clearly the best. Electric Boogaloo is a close second. So I've got, and I will include in the show notes, the full text of the sole article, which is for incitement of insurrection. A ton of news outlets are reporting that, unlike last time, this has Republican votes in that 10 Republican members of Congress voted for the article of impeachment. That's not true. Remember last time, Justin Amash, Republican from Michigan, voted for the article of impeachment, and then they kicked him out of the party. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it's worth preserving that from a historical context. Right. That the fact that they were able to impose, Republicans were able to impose a loyalty oath 2 years ago that they don't now. right?
Yeah, and, I joked in our live show that the one Republican who stood up to Trump in that in the House there had to be sent out in that glass window thing, like in Superman 2, Amash. Yep. He's just out of the Republican universe, out of the planet, gone.
Yep, that condition has changed on the ground. In addition to transmitting the article, which, again, is for incitement of insurrection, not a federal crime. So we're going to talk about, and the president's defenders are going to trot out the same bad nonsense arguments they trotted out last time. Expect to see Alan Dershowitz, expect to see Jonathan Turley claiming that insurrection, inciting an insurrection, is not a severe enough crime to count as a high crime or misdemeanor. Yeah. Because, you know, it's not in the U.S. code. We are aided this time around by the fact that while our founding fathers probably did not anticipate a corrupt, petty, criminal moron being president, and that's abundantly clear from reading the Federalist Papers, they did expect a populist demagogue who could whip up crowds to try and stay in office, right? So by the exact same kind of historical originalist criteria, it's going to be really interesting to watch Republicans, again, not Turley, not Dershowitz, but other mainstream Republicans kind of back away from the arguments that they made 180 degrees to the contrary with respect to Ukraine, right? That is, you must have an actual crime in order to remove the president. I kind of want to congratulate the Democrats on a job well done here of, you know, sort of doubling down and saying, yeah, no, we're not going to play that game. We're not going to try and pitch this as, you know, he violated 18 U.S.C. 1001 or, you know, something like that. Like, we're going to say the president whipped up, like spent weeks claiming that the election was illegitimate and then whipped up a rally, stood back, pointed it at Congress and said, we, and let it go. And that kind of a person shouldn't be the president.
So wait, are you saying that's not illegal, or are you saying the Democrats just didn't care to frame it in that way? They didn't take the bait from last time, I guess, and try to frame it.
I'm saying both. And so let me parse that very, very carefully. I think you could potentially shoehorn some of Trump's comments into something that might look like a violation of federal law, right? I'm not trying to say that there isn't any case to be made, but I will say it this way. Donald Trump has spent his entire adult life acting in that mob boss kind of mentality of, you know, just sort of walking up to the edge and then walking back. And so, for example, his speech and rally before the insurrection, I think, is very clearly protected First Amendment speech, wow. Right? Is it, because that there is such and I think Trump knows this, right? Because under the Brandenburg versus Ohio standard, right, to incite a riot.
I already don't think he knows that. I think what he knows is he's done this before and never pays consequences.
Yes.
So
well, that's
probably
right.
Fine.
And he certainly wouldn't be able to cite a case.
Yeah.
But I think he knows the difference between when you are, I'll say it this way. It was no coincidence that the mob began at the Ellipse out back of the White House, which is where Trump whipped them into a frenzy, and then said, now, why don't you go on down to the Capitol, which is a mile and a half march, right? And I'll be right behind you. No, I won't. Right. That was in my mind, very clearly deliberate to distance himself in time and space from the violence that he knew, he had to know, was about to erupt. And that is because the Brandenburg decision says we protect hateful speech. And we've talked about this case. That was the Ku Klux Klan guy who said, yeah, I want revenge upon, you know, those who would strip the white race of their... Was that the Trump one?
Sorry, I can't remember.
Right. It's tough to tell. That was Brandenburg was the KKK okay. guy. But the Supreme Court said that something becomes hate speech, something becomes beyond the protections of the First Amendment when it leads to imminent lawless action. And if I were defending Donald Trump, which I wouldn't, I don't have to. And as we learned this week from Rudy Giuliani, how dumb, I'm sorry, I realize this is a sidebar. How dumb do you have to be in 2020 to do work for Donald Trump and not get paid up front?
Yeah, like how many Lucy football things could Trump get away with on that? I mean, he has that, like the football is like the retainer or something. Or like, oh yeah, I'll definitely get that drawn up, get that wired over to you.
If you don't, and again, I would never do work for Donald Trump, but in that random hypothetical of, you know, let's suppose it's for a good Democrat cause, but the person who is underlying it is, you know, a criminal scumbag with the history of Donald Trump. Like, if you don't get everything to which you might ever bill as a retainer up front and, you know, converted to specie, right? Like converted to gold and put in the like Scrooge McDuck style vault so that you can swim through it and make sure it's still there, then, you know, you deserve what's coming to you. But anyway.
Are you telling me that Rudy might not be the best attorney?
And he might... I maybe am telling you that. So, I think Donald Trump knew how to keep his hands off, his fingerprints off, and to say sort of just enough to give himself plausible deniability and to make it a bad fit for any individual federal crime. The one that is referenced in the supporting materials that I want everybody to be on the lookout for is what we broke down on the last episode of Opening Arguments, that Donald Trump very clearly committed election fraud, attempted election fraud in Georgia. And the materials and even the text of the impeachment resolution itself mention the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, by name. So in terms of thinking about witnesses, I think we're going to see the House managers attempt to call Brad Raffensperger to testify in Trump's impeachment. And as I look at the supporting materials and you think about the presentations that were made during the first impeachment trial with respect to Ukraine, I'm very happy, right, that there was some internal debate. And obviously the pro-impeachment side won out. But there was some internal debate of, well, do you really want the first couple of days of the Biden administration to be taken up by relitigating the guy that just lost? And when you look at the clear evidence of Donald Trump's not just efforts that are misguided, but you know, or that are completely at odds with reality. But you know, to the things that he's been saying for the past 2 months are unconscionable. And I think a lot of Democrats and a lot of moderates, a lot of independents, you know, have just sort of tuned him out, right? And so they don't know, right? Until the Raffensperger call, like, I knew Trump was saying stupid things. I didn't realize he was saying things like, well, if you exclude all the illegal votes, it's obvious we won all 50 states.
Right? Yeah.
Right. And I think documenting that for the historical record, that we had a president who sat by and said, obviously, I won all the states. And we had a Republican Party who for 6 weeks cheered him on. And it was only at the time that amounted to an armed insurrection in the Capitol that finally a handful said, all right, maybe you've gone too far. I want to preserve that for the historical record.
Yeah, for the communists who teach public schools. Sorry, that'll be just, never mind. That's a more meta commentary on what conservatives will say about the history that we teach. Anyway.
There are a couple other silly arguments that I do want to touch on. You have probably seen that meme that's going around that says, for those of you wondering if it's worth impeaching Trump this time, you know, and then it lists all the things that impeachment supposedly does, of which.
Right. The salary, the travel allowance, the Secret Service.
Yeah.
Some amount of that is true, right? I mean, well, the fact that he can't run again is possible if they convict him, right?
So here's the thing, right? Obviously, Trump has already been impeached once. So the sentence is false, right? Because everything that is listed as a potential consequence is a consequence of conviction.
Well, does it say that it's not? Okay, I took the, maybe this is my fault, but when I read that, I took it to mean like assuming he actually got convicted this time.
Yeah. And so let's assume that, but it doesn't say that, right? It says, for those wondering if it's worth impeaching him this time, it means he, and then here are the four things it says. One, loses his $200,000 plus pension for the rest of his life. That's potentially true. I'm going to talk about that. Two, loses his $1 million a year travel allowance. That is almost entirely false. Third, loses his full-time full secret service detail. That is entirely false. And four, loses his ability to run in 2024. And that is
possible.
Potentially true. Right. Like, yeah. It must be the article of impeachment at the end, right, the trailing sentence says, Donald John Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the Senate can vote on that separately and has in impeachments throughout its history.
Well, look, I gave the meme a slight bit of charity in that if Republicans are going to vote to convict, they will do it because of that last bit. Like, honestly, that's the only way. There is no chance they're going to vote to convict, but then be like, well, but let's have him run again in 2024. I think the only reason they might convict him, maybe, I think there's actually, I'll get your thoughts on this, but I think there's a decent chance Republicans actually might convict in the Senate. I think the only reason they would do that is to make sure he can't run for president in 2024.
I think that's right. And I would add, my estimate of the odds of conviction in the Senate go up every day.
Yeah.
And
well, Mitch McConnell said.
Yeah, there you go.
He would support it. Yeah.
Mitch McConnell said he was open.
Right. I think he said, I'm glad that Democrats are doing it in the House, sort of. Wasn't it to that effect?
It was something like that, right? It was McConnell-esque in, how much
it straddled the line. Well, yeah, but think about what that means. I mean, that's the difference between normal McConnell would have been, these obstructionist Democrats can't get a bear, there's a bear. For him to say anything other than like sheer condemnation that he normally would do over Democrats' efforts to hold Trump accountable for something, that means something. That means something's going on.
I agree with that 100%. And I will go so far as to say, if McConnell votes to convict, I think we'll get the 67 votes, right? I do not see McConnell taking that stance unless he knows he's got 16 Republicans that he's going to bring with him. So that's the, canary in the coal mine, if you're looking for an analogy. But so let's go back to, assume that conviction is possible. Let's work through this backwards. I think I agree with you that Republicans would only vote to convict to prevent Trump from running in 2024. So that's number four. That would then become valid. Number three, the Secret Service Act mentions nothing about impeached or convicted presidents. So that's not true.
Can we amend that?
I would like to do that. I think we would have to amend that prior to, right? It would be ex post facto if we amend it, after Trump is convicted. It would, sort of look petty. Probably we could undertake some regulation. Like, I think you could safely promulgate regulations from the Department of Treasury that says, you know what? Like, we're going to allocate $0 per year for the Secret Service budget. So let's talk about that one and two. Those come from a reading / misreading of the Former Presidents Act, which is contained in the notes section of 3 USC 102. And if that rings a tiny little bell, you might recall that the last time in November when we discussed the Presidential Transition Act, I said, this is not actually codified in the U.S. code. It's codified in the notes section to 3 USC 102, right? And it is. So there are a bunch of these laws. 3 USC 102 is just the presidential salary. And then there are a bunch of these laws that are basically built in as commentary to the law, and they are duly passed laws, but they're stored and presented in an incredibly strange way. It is clear, Section F1 says, and the Former Presidents Act are the benefits that former presidents will receive. And it says a former president means a person, one, this is subsection F1, who shall have held the office of president of the United States of America, two, whose service in such office shall have terminated other than by removal pursuant to section 4 of Article 2 of the Constitution, right, meaning by impeachment, and three, who does not then currently hold such office. So I will add, if Trump's term expires, he might be able to make an argument under this section that his service in office terminated other than by removal due to impeachment.
That's a good
right?
point.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear to me. Like, the intent of the law is super duper clear. If former president shouldn't mean impeached president, that's clearly what they meant. But you know, if you follow the plain language, right, there's nothing in there that says a dog can't play basketball. So, but assume that he loses on that as well, right? Assume that a court says, okay, but your service in your continuing service was terminated because you were impeached. And the whole point of this is to apply to an impeached president. What would you lose? You would lose subsection A, which says each former president shall be entitled for the remainder of his life to receive from the United States a monetary allowance at a rate per annum payable monthly by the Secretary of the Treasury, which is equal to the annual rate of basic pay as in effect from time to time of the head of an executive department. Okay, so he would lose the pension. What about that $1 million travel allowance? That's not a thing. Instead, what we have is the Administrator of General Services shall provide for each former president an office staff, okay, that cannot exceed $96,000 per year. And that staff can then serve the former president when he's doing things, right? Shall be responsible only to him for the performance of their duties. And you lose that staff if you are removed, if you do not qualify as a former president under Section F1. So that's the closest I can find to that. That
but
travel
I like
thing
the
is.
Sound of saying Trump, not even a former president. Under section whatever.
I do like that as well. So, the very last thing that I want to, hit briefly is the distinction between impeachment and the 25th Amendment. The House also passed a resolution 223 to 205 calling upon Mike Pence to engage the 25th Amendment and replace President Trump.
That kind of means nothing, right? Isn't that
it's absolutely that's a statement resolution, right? Okay. It is meaningless. Only one Republican signed onto that one. That's Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, who sort of bent out in front as, you know, being the most vocal anti-Trump Republican in Congress right now. So far less support for that. We talked about on the show how, practically speaking, it's not going to happen. But I want to emphasize it because I have gotten a lot of questions that are basically like, oh, well, does this stop the president from doing X before his term expires? And the answer, no matter what X is no. Right? he's still the president, right? He is the even though this is not a criminal proceeding, right? It's a trial, and the principle of innocent until proven guilty applies, right? So he is still the president. He can still pardon people, right? The pardons clause says the president shall have power of pardons, except in cases of impeachment. That does not mean that when the president is impeached, he can't pardon people. It means that you can't pardon the thing for which someone has been impeached.
Yeah.
Right? He can still pardon people willy-nilly. He will still do so. It's going to be awful.
I've never thought about the other part of that. Does that mean when it says you can't pardon people for what they've been impeached for, does that mean like you can't undo an impeachment, or is there any way to stretch that into like, if we impeach Trump on something criminal, he can't pardon himself for the underlying crime?
Yeah, and there are cases directly on point. It is the former, not the latter. Sadly, good thinking.
I'm sure you would have already told us if it was the other way.
Yep. No, but it's always good to ask and it's good to go through. So yeah, he is going to remain the president throughout this process. If you want him to stop being the president, you have to.
I'm going
to
vote for the 25th
Amendment. Yeah. Well, that's a good idea too. So that's everything about the impeachment resolution and the consequences to be suffered by President Trump.
Yeah, there's not much text to it because it's sort of, I like the idea that, you know, take it for granted that every single reasonable person is going to see started an insurrection as like, yeah, no, that's impeachable. No, really need further explanation on the ins and outs of that one. Yep. No, started an insurrection. Sounds impeachable. Got it. Short articles of impeachment
And again, just take a look for what will be blatant hypocrisy, because this suffers from the same procedural alleged defects as the prior impeachment.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no. I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
Okay. Can't wait to talk about this. Can anything happen for Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and perhaps others, by the way? Those are the kind of the headline insurrectionists, the ones that you may have seen out front. But there are lots of treasonous Republicans working behind the scenes that may not get enough credit. And we'll make sure they get the credit that's due to them. But anyway, there's been talk of the 14th Amendment having something to say about these traitors. What does it say?
So lots of great questions packed into that. The top line answer, and I know you're not expecting me to say this, the top line answer is yes.
Ooh.
There are potential consequences for Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, and the Sedition Caucus. And they do stem from the 14th Amendment, from Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which is right. Almost everybody knows and maybe can quote off the top of their heads if you're me, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, right?
Thou shalt not commit adultery or something.
Right? All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge their privileges or immunities, nor deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor to deny to any person within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, right? So that's the backbone of modern equal protection and due process jurisprudence. It incorporated most of the Bill of Rights to the states. It's you know, the most important thing in the Constitution if you're a lawyer.
I wouldn't have thought that one also goes on to say, apropos of nothing, also don't do a treason.
It has. So there are four extra sections.
I can't believe we forgot to write this in the original thing.
We shouldn't have to say this, but
just in case.
So Section 2 was about how congressional districts would be awarded post the Civil War, right? So not particularly effective these days anymore. Section 4 was about honoring contracts, right? And so because the Constitution says that the federal government would honor contracts by and between the states, they had to add a section that was like, this does not mean we're buying back your slaves or compensating you for the fact that we freed them. Slavery is wrong. People aren't property. Go to hell, you racist nitwits. And then the last provision just says Congress can enforce the provisions by appropriate legislation. Stuck in the middle there is Section 3. This part I had to look up because I didn't know that there's, until researching for the segment, there's actually a fairly robust amount of law and history, but it's all confined to the 19th century, right? We're early 20th. So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says no person shall hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. Well, that seems pretty straightforward, right? And this provision was passed and was used to prevent largely, because remember back then, the senators were appointed by state legislatures.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But it was to prevent states from coming back into the Union after losing the Civil War, and then the whites in those states, particularly using legal procedures to try and prevent African Americans from voting, which, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, from electing the worst of the monsters who had been in the Confederacy and sending them to Congress and being like, oh, yeah, all right, yeah, you let us back in. Here you go. Have a whole bunch of Confederate officers. And Congress was like, yeah, no, we're not going to let you do that and sabotage Reconstruction by sending in these horrible people. You're going to have to send in a different set of horrible people. yeah. But in fact,
and they did.
But no, this provision was invoked more than 30 times in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, up to 1900, in which the House of Representatives collectively would refuse to seat Southern Democrats who had been declared the winner in their state's elections because of various issues, right? Having and principally the determination was made that fraud, violence, or intimidation had been used against Black voters in those states. The House dealt with it in a variety of ways, right? Sometimes they just refused to seat the person and said, hold a new election. Sometimes they sat the defeated opposition candidate. I'm going to suggest, because there's no publicly available version, if there was, I would have linked it on the show notes. But the seminal Law Review article on this is by Morton Stavis, and it is called A Century of Struggle for Black Enfranchisement in Mississippi, From the Civil War to the Congressional Challenge of 1965 and Beyond. It was written in 1987. I'm going to give you the Hine Online citation, so if you are a student or have access to that, you can read old journals. Give the article a read. It's really, 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 really good. So the question is, given that this has been used this way, could it be used against Ted Cruz? And the answer is yes, right? It doesn't have to be the Civil War. And we know that it doesn't have to be the Civil War because of the last time that the 14th Amendment Section 3 was used.
Not during the Civil War?
No, it was used in 1919. Here, we have to look at somebody who, when I was doing the research, has become a new personal hero of mine, a guy named Victor Berger, Victor L. Berger. He was a socialist in Wisconsin. He was an editor and journalist of the socialist newspaper. That's what, that's kind of what it meant to be a socialist back then. You disseminated newspapers, and he was probably the second most prominent socialist in U.S. history, right? Everybody can name Eugene V. Debs. Nobody can name anybody else. You ought to name Victor Berger. So he was elected to Congress in 1910. He was then defeated in 1912. And then you might recall in the early 1910s, there was that World War I thing going on. And like many socialists, Victor Berger was opposed to the U.S. getting involved in World War I.
This is so weird. There's a Victor Berger who's like a Twitter, YouTube personality, and his name is Victor Berger IV. We got to find out.
If that's a relation, I want to get this guy on because Victor Berger is super fascinating. So,
wow. Okay. Side note. Yeah. If anybody knows that, yeah, Vic, yeah, if you're listening.
Yeah. Hit us up. Okay. So like most of the anti-war socialists at the time, prominent ones, Victor Berger was tried and convicted for sedition under the Sedition Act of 1918. And put a pin in that. The Sedition Act of 1918, we've talked about that before in the case of Schenck versus United States, right? That was upheld the constitutionality of the Sedition Act, which prohibited, quote, any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States or the flag of the United States or the uniform of the Army or Navy. And the reason we've talked about that is Schenck v. U.S. is the case that had the Oliver Wendell Holmes employing the clear and present danger test and talking about shouting fire in a crowded theater. And it's why, as good opening arguments listeners, you never, ever use that analogy of, well, you know, the First Amendment stops when we shout fire in a crowded theater. There was never a crowded theater, right? Like, the crowded theater was the United States, and shouting fire was distributing a newspaper that says, maybe we shouldn't get involved in the Great War, right?
Yeah.
So Berger, convicted, sentenced to 20 years in prison under the Sedition Act of 1918. So think about that, right? For the crime of writing a news article that says we ought to have socialism in this country and we shouldn't be involved in this European war. As a result, and here I can use that phrase, Victor Berger was elected to Congress in 1918 from Wisconsin, wow. Right? Remember, he was first elected in 1910, lost, became a prominent anti-war spokesperson, and then was elected in 1918. And then Congress, on January 3rd, 1919, went to seat its members, and they conferred, and they said, well, wait a minute. This guy has been convicted of sedition against the United States. We're going to impanel a committee and figure out if we should seat this guy or not, because it kind of seems like that would meet the criteria of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, right? He's engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States or given aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States.
Wait, and it was just for a newspaper?
Yeah, just for sedition, for writing in a newspaper. We should not get involved in World War One. That commission took most of 1919 to reach its results, but then ultimately decided, quote, that Victor L. Berger, because of his disloyalty, is not entitled to the seat to which he was elected, and that in accordance with the unbroken precedence of the House, he should be excluded from membership, and that further, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress to support the Constitution of the United States, and having subsequently given aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States during the World War, he is absolutely ineligible for membership in the House of Representatives under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. So the seat was declared vacant on November 10th, 1919, and Wisconsin held a special election to fill it. That special election took place December 19th, 1919. Guess who won the special election?
Victor Berger.
Victor Berger, that's right. They were like, oh yeah, but that's just not gonna. So he went back and Congress refused to seat him again, right? And they declared the seat vacant, and this time it stayed vacant until the end of the 1920 general election. So it stayed vacant for two more years, right? And in 1920, Victor Berger lost the general election to Republican William H. Stafford. By the way, narrowly, I should add. And in a way, you know, I kind of feel bad for Stafford here, who was like, well, if you vote for me, they'll let me in the building. And if you vote for Berger, they won't. And still
barely won.
Right. Barely won. So he was seated in 1921. So now put a pin in that and let's take back out that pin I told you earlier about Berger's conviction under the Sedition Act of 1918. As it turns out, the judge in Berger's case was a judge named Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And wow. If you are a baseball fan, you will recognize that name as the racist first commissioner of Major League Baseball. Generally thought of as the guy who was responsible for delaying integration of African Americans into Major League Baseball. But he was a judge, and he was kind of the, like, Judge Judy of 1905, like he was you know, a no nonsense kind of, you know, hang 'em judge, and that's why he was brought in. I said 1905, but he was brought into Major League Baseball as their first commissioner after the Black Sox scandal came to light. You know, to kind of root out corruption and you know, be a no nonsense
kind of convict people of sedition for no reason,
right? And so prior to being named commissioner of Major League Baseball, he was the judge who had tried and convicted Victor Berger. And Victor Berger collaterally attacked that decision, that conviction, on the grounds that Kenesaw Mountain Landis was racist, was biased against Americans of German descent.
Okay.
Huh.
And Berger was of German descent. And so he thought, yeah, everybody, again, you have to remember post-World War I, right? Like this was, oh yeah, Berger, you just wanted the United States to roll over because you're a pro-German stooge. I don't even know what the anti-German slur would have been in 1918 or whatever. But so Berger said, look, like my conviction for sedition had nothing to do with actually meeting the criteria. And I know the fact that this guy hates Germans and I'm German. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
In a case called Berger v. U.S. in 1921. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you're right. This guy's definitely biased against Germans. You're a German. We're vacating your conviction. So that 20 years that Berger had to serve for sedition, gone. What do you think Victor Berger did the minute the Supreme Court vacated?
Ran back for his seat again.
Of course he did. He ran for the Congress again against William H. Stafford and won in 1922, was then instantly seated by the House and served three terms in Congress.
What an uphill battle. That's a heck of a representative.
So here's how I put all of that together. There are two different Article 1 of the Constitution establishes the Congress. And Section 5 has two clauses that talk about some of the powers that Congress has. Clause 1 says each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members, right? That's by majority vote. And then Clause 2 says each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and, with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. So the House gets to judge, are you qualified to be a part of it? And that judgment is just straight-up majority vote. Or they can kick you out, right? They can, you can have been in, and then they'll say, oh, well, now we want to expel you for disorderly behavior. Again, not high crimes and misdemeanors. No question here that it's just, yeah, we don't like you. We don't want you in this House, and so we're going to kick you out. But that requires two-thirds. And by the way, only of, since this is an internal rule, this doesn't have to be a law, right? The Senate doesn't get a say over the House. The House doesn't get a say over the Senate. It's just so, you know, the fact that Senate Republicans are far more likely to be pro-Trump. The fact that House Republicans are far more likely to be pro-Trump than Senate Republicans can't save Cruz and Hawley if we go through this process. But I think I know what you're thinking, which is, well, hey, if the House could kick out Berger just by a majority vote, why would we ever go through the expel process, right? Like, let's just reverse McConnell, every Republican, right? Like, we got a bare majority, right? Like vote them all not qualified and let's be done with it, right? And believe me, if I thought this were possible, I would 100% be behind it. Like, when I say it's time to play hardball, like, yeah, I want an up or down vote on, you know, should you keep somebody who voted with Donald Trump 90% of the time in the Senate? And we'll let Kamala Harris break a lot of ties, right? But unfortunately, there's a Supreme Court case that says we can't do that. I looked it up. It's a case called Powell versus McCormick. And it has to do with a civil rights leader, Adam Clayton Powell, who represented Harlem in Congress. He was the first African-American elected to the House of Representatives from New York. He was incredibly influential, but then became increasingly the target of investigations of corruption and abuse of power. For things like, you know, flying attractive young women on his congressional staff with him to a retreat in Bimini in the Bahamas at government expense. I should add that Powell's defense, quote unquote, here was that white members of Congress did the stuff all the time. He's probably right.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, so he sort of felt like he was being unfairly called out by Congress for enjoying the perks of being a representative when, you know, lots of white people were doing the same thing. We're a rule of law show. And I should point out that when Powell was defeated in 1970, as these allegations came to light, he was replaced by Charlie Rangel, who went on to represent that district with distinction for 30 more years. And until Rangel was caught up in his own ethics situations, the seat is now occupied by Adriano Espalat. You know, and it just a an illustration that at least on the Democratic side of the aisle, it's, you know, the view is not, you know, let's paper over. Right. Like, I think it's fair to say that, you know, Powell was a complex figure, that Rangel was a complex figure. Powell, at least, seems very clear to me, broke the law, committed numerous acts of financial misconduct. And so as a result, 1969, the House voted not to seat him. Okay? Mm. There was a commission that a select House committee, House was majority Democratic at the time, and the members of that committee were mostly Democrats. There were a couple Republicans, and they looked at two sets of issues.
Well, also keeping in mind, 1969 Democrats would be a little bit, you know,
Northern story. That's true, but these were you know, John Conyers was on that committee, for example. So, you know, not a committee of monsters, right? Although, you know, Arch Moore was on it. He was a Republican from West Virginia who would later have his own scandal, right? So in a way, I guess Powell did have a point.
How many scandal-free terms have there ever been? In a, topic for another show.
Topic for another show. So they looked
at— The answer's four, ever.
They looked at two separate sets of charges, right, that said— Powell is ineligible to be seated, number one, because of his age, citizenship, and inhabitancy, right? And the argument was he didn't really live in the district from which he was elected. He was really living in the Bahamas. And then the second was, quote, the status of legal proceedings to which Mr. Powell was a party in the state of New York and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. And then the third, I should add, that was kind of folded into that was allegations of official misconduct for the past decade in office. And that select committee said, yeah, look, he does spend a lot of time in the Bahamas, but he lives in New York. He lives in Harlem. His qualifications are fine. But we think he's guilty of all this misconduct stuff. And so in our judgment, we're not going to seat him under Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1. He's not qualified to serve in the House by virtue of his 10-year pattern of financial misconduct. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. That's the holding of Powell versus McCormick. It said, look, if you refuse to seat him on the basis of his qualification, that is, he's under the age of 30, or I guess for the House of Representatives, under the age of 25, if he is not a U.S. citizen, or if he doesn't live in the district, then you can refuse to seat him for that. But you cannot refuse to seat him on the basis of he's done stuff you don't like, right? You can, however, expel him if he does stuff that you don't like. And the Supreme Court was very clear on that. They were like, yeah, if you don't like this, don't have this committee vote by majority vote, but get 2/3 of the vote of the entire Senate. You kick this guy out.
Huh.
And then, as it turns out, he almost certainly would have been expelled, right? The vote of the House. So I should be clear on this. I kind of elided over this in the history. The House committee said he should be seated, but should be sanctioned, right? But then when it went to a full vote of the full House, they voted 307 to 116, which is well above 2/3.
Yeah.
Not to seat him at all, right? And that, I think, has a lot to do with what you had said previously, right? That has a lot to do with racism, right? Like, yeah. Like very clearly, you know, he had few allies outside of sort of, you know, Northeastern Democrats, right? Like no Republicans wanted to seat him, and not a whole lot of Southern Democrats wanted to seat him either. So after the Supreme Court ruled in 1969 that you could expel him for misconduct or for, quote, disorderly behavior, and that essentially the House gets to judge, you know, what constitutes disorderly behavior, he then lost in that election.
Oh.
So he lost in the primary to, like I said, Charlie Rangel.
Let me make sure I have this all straight, though. So it was the point of this that there's a separate – are there two separate things? Is it refusing to seat someone different than – expelling someone, or what was the takeaway from
that's exactly thing? Right. Okay. And it is that between the two of them, the power to unseat Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley lies, right? So could you argue that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment operates as a qualification and thus only requires a majority vote? I believe on a careful reading of Powell versus McCormick and a careful evaluation of the history, that you could. I think it's absolutely clear to me that it says, right, one of the criteria of being able to serve in either House of Congress is that you did not previously take an oath, then break that oath, then try and get seated again, right? Hmm. And if that's the case, you only need a majority vote to kick out Ted Cruz or kick out Josh Hawley. And we very likely have that, I think.
Wow.
At minimum, if that doesn't work, then you can use the disorderly behavior clause to kick somebody out of the Senate for any reason whatsoever. And I will point out that this was actively discussed back in the Alabama special elections.
Yeah.
That if Roy Moore had won that election, that the Republicans were going to either refuse to seat him or immediately expel him.
No, they weren't.
it was talked about.
I feel like it was talked about, like maybe that's what Republicans would do if they had any sort of soul.
Well, look, you don't have to have a soul, right? Because, the Republican governor was Kay Ivey, right? Very hard right-wing Republican. And so you would just be like, all right, send us somebody who's just as stupid as Roy Moore and just as far like, right.
Can't find him. Yeah, no idea.
But not
we looked everywhere.
Not a pedophile. And in fact, like that's what Alabama now has in Tommy Tuberville, right? Like that, just as much of a troglodyte, just as much of a Trump supporting lunatic, just as ill qualified to actually serve to represent anyone in the United States, in the United States Senate. And you know, nobody's going to kick Tuberville out, although they ought to. So there you go. That is my understanding of the 14th Amendment, Section 3. It's not self-executing, but based on the guideposts that we have, I think we've got a real path to remove those who gave aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. And part of the reason, I mean, I was just fascinated by the tale of Victor Berger.
Yeah.
But everything that happened, right? Like, remember, his sedition conviction was for arguing that the United States should not get involved in World War I. So if you get a pro-Cruz defender of, well, you know, it's not like Cruz let them into the Capitol, right? It's not like Cruz, you know, gave these guys, you know, the guy with the zip ties a tour, you know, and told them, like, this is where you hide out and here's where you can kidnap Nancy. But you don't have to do that, right? That nexus of aiding an insurrection and giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States is could be as thin a connection as was the case in Berger in 1990.
That would be some rough precedent to cite, though, wouldn't it? Like,
it would be.
But point is, this could happen. We could have consequences for this insurrection. So let's do it.
Yeah, let's absolutely do not cede the ground that, you know, because there is an impeachment of Donald Trump, that means that his biggest aiders and abettors get off scot-free.
What would be the criteria you would use? I'm just asking, like, in your opinion, like, would you use the vote against the Biden delegates or something that happened? Because I think there was like six Republican senators, I want to say. Or would you use just statements about the insurrection? What are you using to say here are the senators who should be expelled?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what I would say is that, to me, it is the totality of circumstances surrounding that, right? So with Ted Cruz, you have objected to the vote and then the insurrection took place. Has said it was an automated fundraising email, but literally while insurrectionists were on the floor of the Capitol, sent around a fundraising email that said, "We stand with, you know, everyone who is doing everything they can to try and, you know, prevent the Democrats from stealing this election." So that's not, if that's an automated funder, like that was really bad timing on your part. And then, as we pointed out on the show, that number dropped from 14 to 6 after the insurrection. So it's kind of like, all right, well, you saw where your rhetoric got you, and then are you going to back down? Are you going to say, like Kelly Loeffler, however incompetently, like, okay, well, I have been stoking and fanning the flames of this election was rigged, but now that I've seen that, you know, someone died as a result of that, now maybe I back away from that a little bit. Like, that's the minimum bar, right? And to say, yeah, we want to go after the remaining six people, which, by the way, does include Tommy Tuberville, who doubled down, right? Who saw all of that and said, "Oh yeah, no, that I want more of that." I think that's not a terrible argument.
All right, well, let's do some consequences, folks.
Woo!
All right, Andrew, because we're just feeling so generous, we're gonna more consequences. Couple more lightning round of consequences for that for the shaman guy. what else we got going on here?
Oh yeah, so we've now said, right, what are the consequences for the lawyers? We're going to talk about that next week. For Trump, we talked about that. For his aiders and enablers in the House and Senate. What about the, you know, the foot soldiers, that like Q shaman guy, the dude who stole the podium? Obviously, for the ringleaders, there are the consequences of you're going to be indicted, arrested, and convicted of federal crimes, right? And the DOJ put out an incredibly robust statement earlier this week. They've already handed down 70 indictments, and they expect to hand down hundreds. Good for them. But there is also, and I reached out to our friends, the National Security Counselors, that is NATLSECCNSLRS on Twitter, because I had someone draw my attention to SF-86. And you might be saying, what the hell is that? That is the 136-page standard form, that's what the SF stands for, questionnaire for any national security position, right? So that's how the government conducts its background checks before issuing any clearance level of any kind to any person to receive any information, right? So to get secret, top secret, whatever, you have to satisfactorily fill out this SF-86. And question 29.4 says you must disclose if you have, quote, ever been a member of an organization dedicated to the use of violence or force to overthrow the U.S. government and which engaged in activities to that end with an awareness of the organization's dedication to that end or to the specific intent to further such activities.
Cut and to the guy in the full shaman outfit. No, I haven't. why do you ask?
And that was, and I posed that as a two-part question, right? Because you are 100% correct that folks are going to answer no to that question who participated in this riot or supported groups in this insurrection that supported the insurrection. And the National Security Counselors came back and said, oh, no, like if this 29-4, if you were related to this in any way whatsoever, you are 100% required to disclose it. And if you fail to do so, if you lie and you hide it, then that's an instant disqualification from ever holding a security clearance, ever being able to be hired for any government position that requires a background check. Here's what they said, quote, "Lawyers can make all the weaselly arguments they want about the various different qualifications in that question. But if you check yes, right, if you say, oh, yeah, well, I was part of this group that did some light treason, right, that's a death sentence for your clearance." Okay, that makes sense. "And checking no if you had anything to do with anybody involved would be an automatic denial under guideline E for lack of candor or attempting to mislead the investigator." And I'm not surprised to see that. I was aware of that as a standard, and I've often talked about it analogously in the bar exam. Don't make a justification in your head as to, like, technically why something might apply or might not apply. You know, like, answer the damn question, right? And if you don't, if you've lied, if you've misled, if you've engaged in a lack of candor, they continue, quote, "They don't care about weaselly legal arguments. If security adjudicators had their way, lawyers would never be allowed to have clearance. And anyone who sounded like a lawyer would automatically be bounced for trying to mislead them." So here's the takeaway from that. We've talked about a lot of ways about holding people accountable. If you have an Uncle Frank in your life, you can write a letter to the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. You can write a letter to their superior, and you can say, hey, if this person is in the process of filling out this application and has left section 29.4 blank, you should be aware of their connection to and involvement with the armed insurrection on the United States of America. So that's out there, and that's a way for us to hold these folks accountable on a personal level. Don't take legal advice from a podcast. You know better than that. But yeah, that's real. And as far as I can tell, those who vet security clearances would take this very, very seriously.
That was everything I hoped for and more. Andrew, let's hope these consequences actually happen. Tune in on Tuesday for even more consequences.
Absolutely.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Can I start a new streak to not pork? Here we go.
A state law provides funding for public students using a complex formula. One of the major components of the formula takes into account property values surrounding the schools. This leads to a disparity in student funding, as schools located in areas where property values are high have substantially more funding than schools located in areas where property values are not high. A group of students from a school located in an area with low property values challenges this law on the basis that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So, wow, how much more topical could you be?
Yeah, I thought this is just how it works. So,
who confused. Will prevail? A, the state, because the state can show that the law is necessary to achieve a compelling government interest.
Okay.
B, the state, because the students will not be able to show that the law is not rationally related to any legitimate government interest.
Okay.
C, the students, because the students will be able to show that the law is not substantially related to an important government interest. Or D, the students, because the state will not be able to show that the law is rationally related to a legitimate government interest. So, well, I won't editorialize. You know.
Yeah, this is tricky because I thought this was just how school funding works, and I don't remember this being, like, overturned in a 14th Amendment case. So that leads me toward the state winning. I think this has to do with what kind of basis, you know, we're looking at. Like, it seems to be different levels of testing the burden there. Does the state have to show, like, a substantial thingy? Does it have to show any sort of rational thingy, you know, that those lawyer law talking words. And so, gosh, I feel like this is just how this works. So I'm a little worried. Equal protection. So I think that part of it might be that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, I don't know that it, like, protects people based on income. Like, is that a protected class? Because I, in my mind, I'm already taking for given. I thought this is how school funding currently works. So it tells me that I feel like it's got to be the state will win this case. And if so, why? That already could be wrong. I don't know. I could just be incorrect on that, but I'm pretty sure. And so my thinking will be, if the state can win on this case, or does, it would be because all it needs is some, like, barely, you know, fogged mirror test of like, well, the state can say this has to do with the with some sort of government interest. And so let's see, between A and B are the state answers. A, the state, because the state can show that the law is necessary to achieve a compelling government interest. See, I don't think it has to meet that test. That actually sounds more strict than it would need to be, because I don't think that income is a protected class, you know, like low income. I think if this were like more tied to race or something, which, I mean, you could argue it ultimately is, but it does, it doesn't seem to be anywhere in the question that they argued that way. So I don't know. Like that, if it was based on race or something that was protected, like gender or something that's protected, I think you would need a higher standard. But gosh, I'm thinking that you don't need that for this. So B, the state, because the students will not be able to show that the law is not rationally related to any government interest. So I was going to go with B, but I'm a little bit questioning it, because it's weird that it puts the burden on the students. Like, I would have thought the answer would be B, the state, because the state can show that it's rationally related to a government interest, rather than the students will not be able to show that the law is not rationally related to any government interest. Maybe that's still the same thing, but it seems a little weird to put the burden on the students. Maybe that just means like the state kind of gets the benefit of the doubt unless the students can prove otherwise. So this is a weird one, because I feel like, you know, if I were just voting with my heart here, I feel like it would be, you know, C or something. The students would win because the students will be able to show that the law is not substantially related to an important government interest. And maybe there's some case somewhere that I didn't hear about where this was ruled this way. I'm going to vote with what I think is reality and assume that this is that I'm right about that. I'm going to go with B. And I think that's the level of burden the state would need to show in this case. We'll see if I start a new streak or if I instantly pork my one question streak. B is my final answer, although if I had to vote with my heart, I would vote probably C or D.
All right. And with that in mind, you know how to go ahead and enter this competition. Share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your answer, your reasons. Therefore, we will find a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. I will start us off. Oh, by the way, patrons, enjoying A Lot Awful Movies coming at you very soon. We are already due for another one right now, Andrew. Let's get on that immediately.
thanks for that hint, Thomas.
Yeah, just realizing. Definitely didn't just think of that now. thanks to Kid from Missouri, fighting Josh Hawley's political career since 2016. Oh, congrats. Well, we've given you some more ammo for that cause, I think. Daniel O'Connell, Ben, Mergem Dornauer, Peggy Skelly, I effing love you guys. Aw, we effing love you back. Haley McLean, David Paulson, the Friday Night Fan Fiction Podcast will read literotica about you eventually. Hopefully it's tasteful. Okay. Super Friend, Vox Princeps, Ben Verhagen, and your turn, Andrew.
Thank you to Rifle Butt Sarah, the Ghost of Larry Nichols, Michael Johnstone, Jordan Palomar, Rachel Jokinen, Laura Williams, Garbage Pig, Drew Vogel, NB, Omnisexual Millennial Socialist Satanist in Republican Clothing. That sounds like it's going to tick somebody's box for sure. Linda Larson and Patty M. Demuri. Thank you all so much for supporting us over at patreon.com/law.
And that's our show. Oh, three happy ones in a row, Andrew. And I didn't even have to talk about the fact that my Sharks are playing again tonight. Finally. Finally, the Sharks. Longest I'll ever have to go in my life, fingers crossed, without getting to see my San Jose Sharks. It was like a year almost because of this COVID stuff. Crazy. Should never have to happen again. Human rights were violated, okay? No one should have to be without their San Jose Sharks for this long.
Sure.
All right. Well, I'm sure you're all enjoying hockey, right? Everybody's just like me. And then, no, they probably don't even know that's back on. We'll see you on Tuesday for even more consequences.
Woo!
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.